Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. What if you only cared about yourself and nobody else, but you did really good work? The founder of TED, Richard Werman, is just that. He claims that he only cares about himself, but as everybody knows, he does pretty good work. So he's just going to share his thoughts. It's a very colorful interview, and I think you can learn a lot from just listening and kind of absorbing what he says. Then I have a celebrated teacher that comes in and talks about his anarchy game. He teaches high school students about governments and leadership through different games that he's created. And he's going to be coming on and talking about why anarchy doesn't exist and how he uses this game to teach the kids about that. So now here's Richard Werman. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Nice for you to have me.
I guess
I will be either welcome or not welcome when the interview is finished.
Well, let's hope you're welcome. Well, I'm pretty excited to have you because you have done so many things. There's some famous things that everyone knows about, like creating TED and TEDMED, but you have done so many other things that are very interesting that I want to talk to you about, because I think those are the things that have really changed the business landscape, but people don't realize it's the behind the scenes things and that they've all used but don't realize where the source of it is. And you've also written 83 books and you've done so many different things, and so I want to get into that. But before we get into that, I just quickly want to ask you a couple questions about TED and move on, because I know that the future is much more exciting for you than the past. So let me ask just a couple quick questions for you. What was your intent for creating TED?
Well, the overriding intent of everything I do was an early recognition that the big design problem, and I'm originally trained as an architect and designer, the big design problem is designing your life. And so each thing I do, whether it is a conference or a book or a conversation or a trip or some invention, is all to assuage my basic ignorance, my curiosity and my ignorance, and to put myself in a position like TED, to be able to have the dinner party I always wanted to have but couldn't, to invite anybody I wanted to come and have a conversation, to do a book about a subject I don't understand, to have a conversation with extraordinary people, to invent new paths and new cartographies and new patterns of ways of looking at things. I mean, that's really a number of students call and want me to answer three or four questions because they're doing a paper and they want it, and their professor said, you ought to get in touch with this person, so they send me an email. And the standard answer for 90% of them from one of my assistants is, Mr. Werman cannot answer your questions because he doesn't type. He would like me to tell you that his goal in life is to have an interesting life, and so far today has been interesting. And that's it.
I got to tell you, I completely understand your intent behind TED, because I think it is how I feel about this radio show that I do, because it's called Business Game Changers, and I get to talk to all sorts of fascinating people and fascinating topics, and it's really in line with what you're talking about. But you went on after TED, and you created TEDMED.
I created TEDMED while I was doing TED.
Okay.
I did TED, I did the first Federal Design Assembly, and I did the AIA National Conference, and I did the International Design Conference in Aspen. So, you know, I didn't come out of an egg.
You did. Well, yeah, you were doing a million things at once, right? You're like a typical genius guy that does a million things at once, and you want to have a creative thing, and one idea leads to another idea, and there you go.
At best, TED was an elaborate hobby. It never was my life. When I was doing TED, I was doing the Access travel guides and other things, and consulting to the Pacific Telesis phone company. I don't do one thing. I always do several things.
Well, and you talk about this Access City Guides. Those are graphics and logical editorial organization to make places like New York, Tokyo, and Rome understandable to visitors, correct? That's what I read in your bio.
Well, they made them understandable to me.
and hopefully it's understandable to more people because of that.
But, as it turns out, but they were done for me and my understanding, and the end result was that it did have an effect on others.
And it's pretty much the de facto guide, right, in a lot of these?
Oh, I don't know. I don't follow up on that. That's my past.
Okay. Well, this is something about your past, and I'm hoping that you're interested in talking about this because I think it's something that is important. Your mentor is Louis Kahn.
That's correct.
And why do you see him as your mentor?
Well, I did the first book on him when I was 26, and it was my first book and his first book on him. He had been asked by a lot of people. I was working for him, and he was the master, the guru. And I was shocked afterwards that he had said yes, because he had turned down so many people. And then after he died, I did the collection of all the writings and speeches and that he had done, and none pictures of his buildings, just what he had to say, and what others had to say about him. And the first line of the introduction, which is only a page and a quarter, the first line is, he was the youngest person I ever knew. And that's my goal in life. And it's what I hope that when I pass that I've learned from him, is how to be in a profound way the young person who says the emperor has no clothes.
And being young is a mindset.
Being young is an innocence, a way of looking at something in a completely opposite way. Mr. Chow, the restaurateur, says, when I think I've heard the truth, I believe the opposite is truthier. And Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, said, when I have a profound thought, I look at its opposite because I know that's profound also.
That's actually an interesting way to look at it.
And so my life is looking at things just in an innocent way. I don't work for anybody. Nobody's ever asked me to do a book. Nobody's ever asked me to do a conference. I have no clients. I just survive.
Well, it sounds like you're thriving, which is hard to do for a lot of people. How would you...
Fortunate. I am really fortunate that somebody as abrasive as I am also has a fair amount of charm.
Yeah, people who are abrasive, people who are really bright and artistic tend to come across as more abrasive, and so they always have to work on that just so they can get their stuff done. And you do it naturally, huh?
I don't know what I do naturally. It's hard to, it's impossible to understand others and difficult to understand yourself.
I would agree with that. Okay, so your latest book is called 33, Understanding Change and the Change in Understanding. Why do you use the number 33? What is the significance of that?
Well, that's the last book that I published, I don't have a publisher. I don't have an agent. You can't get it in a bookstore. So it really is quite counterintuitive. But it is the last book that I published, but I'm working on a bigger book now. But what was called 33, because when I decided to do it, it was a sequel to a little fable I had written 33 years before. So I just called it 33. Since I'm doing it, I can call it whatever I want.
Yeah, you can. That's my, I play hockey, and that's my number in hockey. It's my daughter's number as well. So it's a cool number.
It's an interesting number, which I found out only after I decided to call it 33. Christ supposedly died at 33, but so did Evita Peron.
Oh.
A lot of 33s that come up, strangely. Now, I have also found that for whatever reason I decide 17 is an interesting number. Then I start seeing 17 everywhere.
Yeah, that's how it works, right?
how it works. Yeah.
I see business game changers everywhere now.
Yes. Anyway, so.
What? How can people get your books then if they're not available in bookstores?
I think 33 you can get it on Amazon or as a used book, or they don't get them. I don't reprint my books. And so, the copies I have left after a few years, I grind them.
Really?
Why would I lie to you? I don't know you well enough.
You're right. Okay, so you're the first person to coin the term information architect, and which, you know, I was an information architect when I first started out of college. So you coined my existence. But how did you come to that?
I don't try to get mileage out of that. I mean, there's an information architect society that has a convention every year. I don't even know if they know about me, and I'm not invited. And I understand to somebody else that it's going to be Information Architecture Day in April or something. They have 40,000 people going to celebrate it around the world.
Well, information architecture.
They haven't called me. I coined it because I was national chairman of the American Institute of Architects annual conference in 76, which was a big conference, 5,000 people, because it was in Philadelphia and celebrating the bicentennial. And they asked me to be chairman, and I called it the Architecture of Information.
And then it just went from there.
Uh-huh.
Well, and as you know, now that we have data everywhere, it's really becoming...
It's become a part of our language. And
yes.
I also did a book called Information Architects.
Okay. So you also have something that I really want to talk about here. You have this live urban observatories around the world. That sounds incredibly interesting. What is that?
Well, I urge your listeners, and this is a very easy, if they have a pencil, I'm saying get a pencil out, get a pen out, get your iPad out, your iPhone. It's a very easy web application. I mean, it's free. I'm not selling anything. If you go to urbanobservatory.org/preview, I'll say it one more time, urbanobservatory.org/preview, there's 60, 70, 80 cities there. It'll go up to 100, then 1,000 that you can, for the first time, and I'm telling you the first time, and you have to believe me, we've done all kinds of proof of concept. The first time that cities, you can see them comparatively, not only the same scale, but with the same legends, and about 25 or 30 levels of information compared, some of all of it live off the cloud, some of it actual live information about noise and weather and different things like that, and traffic. And the cities have given it to us. We've translated it into a new cartography so it can be compared. For instance, one city will call an airport and all that commercial, another will call it transportation, another will call it open space, another will call it public space. You can't compare the patterns of one city relative to another, or the population, or the this or that, or the scale of it, in any of this. It doesn't exist in our literature.
So
the first and only place you can start having a common language for comparing where 51% of the human race lives.
How many different urban cities do you have?
We have, I said we have about 70 now, and it'll go up to 100 in a few months, and then it'll go up to 1,000.
Wow. So your goal is to get up to around 1,000 or whatever. So it's looking at all the detail, the cultural differences, and words create a lot of cultural differences.
I think you just look at it online. Look at this website, and you can bring up any three cities in the list and any one of 20 or 30 layers of information and compare them. And if you make one bigger, the other one gets bigger. If you make one smaller, the other one gets smaller. You can change it. You'll find it really fun.
And what if you had a goal for this? What would you really like to see come out of it?
Oh, it's well on its way. It'll evolve the way it wants to evolve, and I'm on to my next thing. It'll be fine. It'll eventually have 1,000 cities. It'll be in three dimensions within a year. The maps will change. But the basic principles of comparative analysis will stay there, and it'll become a way that you can start then one city talking to another, or corporations figuring where they want to go, or people understanding what works and doesn't work places. it'll become part of a language. It's a, in a sense, a primitive thing. It's the beginning of something. I mean, you wouldn't want to be operated on in a operating room where the doctors, one doctor uses the English system of feet and inches, and the other doctor uses the metric system of centimeters and millimeters to cut you open. So you want to have common language for doing things. Within sciences, they have different languages. There's very little standardization. We think it exists, but it doesn't.
Yeah, when I did a lot of data architecture in the day we did, I worked with University of Minnesota. I actually brought them in to train all the senior engineers at Belcore and me and all these people. And we learned through this process how one word can really mess people up. And if one word is thought differently by one person from another person, you can create a lot of animosity and a lot of problems just because they view that one word differently. And the important thing is to get on the same page from a standpoint of a word, and then you can get so much more accomplished. It was an interesting process that we went through.
It's true in every field. Astrophysicists and small particle physicists, both physicists, look at the periodic table differently, our fundamental building block. They look at the word elegance differently, which is a physics term. Doctors use different words for things to mean different things. I mean, it's pathetic. So I'm an architect, I'm an urban planner, I love cartography, so I thought I would start at the bottom with cartography. And the first book I did when I was 26, I'm going to be 80 next month. The first book that I did when I was 26 was The Plans of 50 Cities in the World, all to the same scale. So I've been doing the same thing for my whole life. I'm kind of Johnny One Note.
It doesn't seem like you're Johnny One Note. But, okay, you have this incredible conference coming up, and I think it's really very close to what, you know, my genre is. And it's called the 555 Conference. It consists of 5 experts, 5 predictions of the future, game-changing patterns for 5 years in the future.
Yeah.
Basically, finding the future first. So basically, me and you have a competition going on who's finding the future first.
I thought, for me, this is not for the public. I mean, there'll be some people come, I guess, but that's not the reason I'm doing it. Is I got tired of listening to speakers either selling charities, which they mostly do now at TED, is selling how to make a better world. I know that sounds un-PC. Well, I am. How to give to a charity and how to sell guilt. Or they're talking about their last book or their last building or something like that. And I realized that the only thing that interests me is game-changing, not incremental change.
Paradigm shifts.
That's fascinating to me. And 5 years is about the right time that you can make a prediction that has some gravitas to it. 3 years is what most companies plan for financially. 5 years, that last 2 years, is their uncomfortable zone, and that becomes the interesting zone. And then the follow-up two questions is, how does the world prepare, and what are the unintended consequences? So, for instance, which will happen in the next 5 years, there will be a vaccination for the prevention of malaria, and therefore that will lead to 1 million people not dying, and that's wonderful. How does the world prepare for that when you realize that this mostly occurs? Those 1 million people are often children in areas where are overpopulated now, where they have a lot of children because so many die, and they need. Is a natural result of in births when there's a high death rate, the people have more children. So what happens is you're going to have 1 million children in places where they not only have a lot of children now, but they don't have enough to eat. So each year we will have 1 million more people living, which we should. It's wonderful. This is a terrific thing to cure malaria. It's been a death, and more people have died of it than almost anything else over the last few centuries. However, you're going to dump them into a place where they don't have enough to eat, and if you don't prepare for the unintended consequences, well, what I'm saying is whatever you predict is going to happen, you ought to think of how the world prepares.
because there's much more.
Always unintended consequences to every change.
Yes. Well, how about energy? What do you think's going on in the energy sector?
Going to be a big breakthrough in battery life. It'll be about four times more, which if a car can go with the current batteries for 150, 200 miles, it certainly negates this whole charging thing, because you can charge it overnight any place in fast charging with a simpler grid and network. And it does away with the idea for gasoline, but it doesn't do away with the idea that you have to generate electricity.
Well, you always have to generate energy somehow, right?
Generate energy, and if it isn't by the end result spewing gas, out into the atmosphere and carbon dioxide, how are you going to do it, and how do you set up the grid to then service a new form of battery?
Well, what do you think about solar and some of these independent sources of energy where you're not really on the grid?
I can't tell you anything you don't know or your listeners don't know. So that's a question that I'm not an expert in. You're as much an expert as I am. We all know that wind energy. We all know that there's sun energy. We all know that there's water energy. But those are things that we know exist, and there's going to be breakthroughs in those to help. It all has to be, those are the unintended consequences. Which one has a leap forward because, or several of them might. It might be a hybrid of several different kinds of energy sources.
Do you think going to energy we know the answer to this, energy, changing the source of energy will fundamentally change our geopolitical situation?
Well,
what do you think of some of that? I'm just trying to pick your brain and see what you think about things.
Every single thing that has happened will continue to happen. The change in energy and our dependency on gas, look what it did to the power in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, which was a country that had no resources, and then all of a sudden overnight became a center of money.
Yeah, Abu Dhabi.
Of wealth, because of
or Saudi Arabia. Yeah, there's also other things going on there, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
Of Saudi Arabia. I mean, yes, of course, everything changes everything. You can't predict all the changes, but you can see some of the, I mean, there's going to be the Northwest Passage. You're going to be able to go from the Atlantic to the Pacific. You already has been several ships go through. It's going to be a year-round thing where shipping is going to use that instead of the Panama Canal, because you can have ships of any length. That's going to have an effect on Panama Canal and Nicaragua and also certain ports, in the northern Asia.
Have you been looking at some of the agricultural studies that they're doing where they're finding structures all over the world, and they're finding things that people don't realize are there? I mean, millions of structures in Africa, and the facts and things that they're finding is really changing.
I don't know what you mean by structures.
Well, they found millions of stone structures in Africa where there supposedly people weren't supposed to be. They're finding structures all over the place to indicate that we as a people were pretty civilized for a lot longer than we thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're finding bones that of animals that are, and they found this for a long time, there's a lot of news clippings and a lot of things, of animals that are huge. Like, so they think that in the past we were much larger. Like they found animals, like they found turtles that were 10 times the size. They found, fireflies that were bigger. I mean, every single animal, they found it to be a lot bigger in the fossil records.
Uh-huh.
And it's pointing to so many different things. The
a couple follow-up questions.
Yeah.
Yes, they found something bigger. But the way you're saying it is, in a sense, there's a certain way of interpreting how you're describing it, is that bigger is better.
I'm not. I'm just saying it's different than what our understanding is.
Well, but everything changes. Everything is – to think that – why should anything stay the same? So some things maybe are bigger and some things maybe are smaller.
It's happening in mass
– well, as an animal, we have about a trillion cells in our body.
Yep.
Of those trillion cells, 90% of them are other animals. only about 10% are human cells, unique to human beings. Those 90% are individual animals that you can find in LaRouche's book of animal life as separate animals with different names. And they all make up a human body. But they also make up the body of a buffalo. I mean,
sure.
That we are really zoos, not different species all the time. We are utterly dependent on and interconnected with other forms of life. Everything changes. And there, you know, when I grew up, and even when you grew up, if you took biology, you were told that all life comes from the sun and photosynthesis. The basic theory today is that more life comes from chemosynthesis, the absolute opposite. When it was first discovered a short time ago, 25 years ago, 50 years, not discovered, but postulated about the black holes, it was thought to be the most vacuous place and everything would be sucked into it. And then the person who discovered it refuted that 20 years later and said, no, it's the densest part of the universe. The absolute opposite. So things are, everything we know is going to be changed. There's nothing I've ever said or that I know now that I believe will be the truth or be accepted as an operative truth in 40 or 50 years. But you just live with these things as an operative.
Your paradigm is what it is today, and it'll continue to change and evolve.
Helps us live a life and make decisions, fine, but you know it's going to change. I know it's going to change because it always has.
Well, what do you think about the idea that...
Not me at all.
What do you think about the idea that people fight that to a degree where it holds us back?
Well, now I'll say something that will get you many letters, so don't give out my address. I don't care about people.
Oh, you care about me? You're talking to me.
No.
You don't care about me.
I have never met you. I don't know what you look like. I don't know what eye contact is with you. And I don't know you enough to say I care or don't care about you. I know that when I do a conference, for instance, I don't think for a second, for a moment, about who I invite based on who the audience would like me to have. I don't care about the people, the audience that's out there, because I can't conceivably know what they're thinking.
So why do you...
Wait, let me finish this, young lady.
Okay.
Conceivably know what you're thinking. So what I try to do is good work. Historically, I know that the work I've done has had what seems like a positive effect on people. But it's not because I tried to have a positive effect. Nor do I follow up on what effect it has or doesn't have. I just try to do good work. My goal is to understand things, put them in a form that I can understand them better, and go on with my life. And try to do it well and responsibly and as honestly as I can. But I don't serve people.
You serve yourself.
I serve the work.
But the work is...
It's called Worship the God of Understanding.
But the work is honest, and it's good.
I try to make it as honest as I can, and I try to make it in a form that I can understand it. I recognize that I'm not very smart, so if I can understand it, likely other people will too, but I don't do it for that reason.
But anything that you do where you're honest to yourself and you do good work serves others as a byproduct.
I guess so. I don't know, but that's not my conscious effort.
Okay, that's fair. I think that's kind of healthy. That's healthy.
I don't care if it's healthy or not.
You do too, because you care about your own health, right?
I care about the work. I care about transforming my ignorance into some patterns of understanding.
But you care about your own health.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. You care about your mental health.
Yeah.
And that's mentally healthy.
Yeah. Okay, you got 3 yas in a row. You win.
Okay. So when do you plan on having this conference that you're going to do, this 555 conference? When do you think it's going to be held?
3 places. The first one will be next September, and then the second will be a couple months later, and the third one will be a couple months after that. It'll be 5 predictions in each of the 3 places.
And will they be different or the same?
No. 5 different ones.
Okay. And do you have your experts all lined up, or are you still kind of muddling?
I haven't invited them, but I have it curated.
Okay.
And my success rate is usually fairly high.
Oh, I think so.
I mean, success in getting people to come.
So do you have any ideas of some of the things that you're going to be talking about?
Just told you two. How many do you need? Why should I give away the show?
Okay, well then, I have some things. I happen to have some game changers that I would like to, a little more that I'd like to talk to you and get your opinion on.
Go ahead.
Okay, have you heard about the breakaway civilization concept that's been kicked around out there and a lot of experts are talking about?
Nope.
Well, the concept behind the breakaway civilization is that the education level and the technology has gotten so far in certain subgroups that they are disconnected from the rest of society, and the majority, especially in the United States, the mass amounts of money are going to that group, and they just keep getting farther and farther away from the base, or, you know, from the masses.
I don't know factually whether mass amounts of money are going to that group, but I will. You're going to say it, so
What's being postulated. That's what's being talked about.
Okay, well, that's what's being talked about to me is not fact yet.
Yeah,
so
that's fair.
I don't want to, in a sense, even invisibly on the radio, nod at what you're saying until I have some real knowledge that that's so. But let's just continue your argument. Where does it go from there?
Well, you know, the point is that the money, the technology, there's a gap between the understanding. And this is whether there's money going to that, well, the money in Silicon Valley and other places are going to a lot of latest technologies. But the point is that there's a huge gap from what the average person understands and can implement in their paradigm in their normal life from the paradigms and the understanding of people who are engaged and engrossed in these environments.
It's interesting, and it's always been that way in some form. Always. And I can certainly go back 2,000 years. We learned that the Bronze Age was one of those ancient ages, right? That was an early age. We look at our early history, thousands of years ago, and we look at the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, and we look at different ages, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If I asked you to ask the next 10,000 people you see to go out and in a day find you some bronze or make some bronze or tell you how you make bronze or where they would mine the copper, which is, of course, a major part of bronze, and figure out how to get the copper out of the ore and then what do you mix with the copper ore, which is, you know, there's two different things you mix with it to make bronze, and realize that those things that you mix with it, which are arsenic and tin, or tin, to make bronze, and those are mined about 300 or 400 miles at the closest near where you mine copper around the world, and realize how sophisticated and complicated that is to make enough bronze to make a great Chinese bronze urn, and realize that that happened thousands and thousands of years ago, and that thousands and thousands of years ago they had this complex knowledge, and we don't have any of it today.
That's what I was talking about earlier, which we can go back to, but keep going.
And they still make bronze, but they make it because a few people have that knowledge. And in the end, all the specialized knowledge for doing everything is always with a few people here and a few people there, that what you're saying doesn't mean anything to me. Because I know how to do absolutely nothing. I'm talking to you on the phone. I wouldn't know how to make a phone, build a phone, or explain how the phone works to anybody, except in the most stupid primitive terms. Next to it is a little box of Kleenex, because my nose runs in the morning. And I know the principles of making paper, but I don't know what that paper is made out of, whether it's made out of old cotton or whether it's made out of wood or it's made out of some synthetic material. And the making of the box, again, which is a different form of paper and wood, is very complicated. It's not such a simple thing. And, in fact, the making of paper by Gutenberg a kind of paper that he can dampen so it could go on his press and be pressed into the type. That was a breakthrough in itself because they're mostly using vellum, which you can't do that with. So that's a breakthrough.
But, and that came from the illness, the mass, what do you call it, the plague that was going on. Right? Do you know that story?
I know all those.
You're way ahead of me. Go ahead.
I know all the plague stories and how the plague allowed people to not starve and had an effect on the manufacturing of make the invention of things to farm and inventions of the things to weave because there wasn't enough people, but everybody had enough to eat, and it happened in the beginning of the early Renaissance. There's a whole bunch of, that's an unintended consequence of a horrible thing.
Bad things can make some good things happen.
That's right. That's what I was talking about before.
Horror makes you get out of your box pretty quickly.
Well, if you're the 2,000-year-old man, of course, 2,000-year-old man was completely apocryphal because they were talking about cavemen with, Brooks in that amazing riff that he did called The 2,000-Year-Old Man that was so popular about 40 years ago. And when they asked him what did he use for transportation, he thought for a minute, he said, well, we didn't have buses, we didn't have trains, we didn't have anything like that 2,000 years ago. What we used for transportation was fear. Saber-toothed tiger came, we ran. What you're saying about money going to is absolutely, it's not a new pattern. It's an absolute existing pattern that will keep on changing. It's a very natural pattern. I mean,
but do you think with technology and our understanding of things becoming faster and faster that it's more prominent today?
Faster and faster. There's certain areas that they understand, but the person who's making the computer or doing some of that science, you ask them to make you a flint spearhead.
You're right. They can't. Most can't do
that.
They can't
make bronze. That's the whole point I was making. They can't make anything that they're actually doing.
You're right.
So, no, I don't think there's any strange thing about it at all.
So my question to you
is, what is happening is there's going to be, we are currently in the midst of a blurring between white collar, blue collar, and black collar. You know what white collar is, you know what blue collar is. Black collar is creative and technology. And there's a blurring between that and the 4-year Bachelor of Arts degree in college, and that whole means of learning, that's in a process of radical change, and in the next 10 years will radically change.
Well, how do you see that radically changing?
Don't radically change by taking the broken system, which they're doing now, and making it bigger. So there's a thing called Coursera, which now takes, they readily admit that the university system is broken with a professor talking to 200 people. So now that same professor can now talk to 10,000 people at a time because of technology. So they're making a bigger broken system, and they're not in a fundamental way changing education into learning.
Well, because people need to think hard and work through problems and do and think and stumble outward. I had a professor that thought that learning is a stumbling outward process.
But you're missing my point. The difference is a board of education, not a board of learning. Education comes from the top down with specific things you have to take. Learning comes from interest from the bottom up. And so far, including myself, nobody's invented a viable, large system of increasing curiosity and guiding people in their interests instead of teaching them what's in a previously done book.
Do you know a lot of people trying to solve that problem?
You need guides to connect interest to interest to interest. If you're interested in anything, it connects to everything. Are people working on it? I don't know. I'm thinking about it, but I'm not people.
You're a person. You're part of the people.
But I'm not going to have that effect. But I'm interested in it.
Well, the issue, right, with education is that you need to have a certain amount of knowledge on all sorts of things in order to be able to do what you want in your interest area.
I don't agree with that. I think you can be very specialized and still have a very interesting life. And I think you can be a generalist and have an interesting life. I think we live in an age of also. You can be this way and you can also be that way. I don't think there's a way of doing things. I think it's much more complex than that. I think somebody can, sitting around a fire that they made by accident, by a spark that hit some little furry plants, and who learned how to really keep that fire going, can do that, and he probably couldn't hunt. And the guy that could hunt probably couldn't make the spear. And the person that made the spear couldn't have a baby. And the person that made the baby couldn't cook. And the person who couldn't, who painted on the side of the cave wall for their memories, probably couldn't do any of the other things. It's fine to be specialized. It's also fine to be generalized. I don't have any, there's no formula for shit. It's just all the same.
The smartest person I've ever worked with was a person who had a fifth grade education. He didn't think much of himself, and he ended up messing up his whole life with drugs and things. But I think that points to your thing, that it doesn't, what you can accomplish and what you can do doesn't necessarily mean education. He could fix any equipment. You give him a piece of a broken equipment, he could figure it out. He could figure out anything faster than anybody I knew. And he only had a fifth grade education.
Well, see, I think it's the number five doesn't mean anything. I think you should have lifelong learning, and we should get rid of the word education.
Well, that's what he was. I mean, he just could.
Right, so, but the fifth grade doesn't make any difference. He probably learned his whole life.
Oh, I'm sure, yes, to be what he was doing.
I think in some things, you maybe should go to a very strict, organized way of learning certain subjects that might take 20 years. And that's okay too. And it can be a very rigorous and organized way of certain skills that you want to do. You know, I suspect to learn certain skills to go up in space or do that. If you have to learn a certain, when you're isolated in space, you have to have a certain group of skills that unlike anybody else's skills. And you have to be taught that in a rigorous way, and that's fine too. I'm not against that. I'm not saying what I'm saying is universal. I'm saying we should be given permission to find our path of our interest and have them absorbed by us in the most efficient way.
So you say that you're not good at anything. Correct. Or you're not good. There's a lot of things you're not good at. Well, what are you good at? Because okay. I know you're... You're not, but you're better than most people at some things. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing.
That phrase you used, I have no idea what it means. Most people.
So you're good at nothing, and you're interested in some things.
I've been really fortunate to survive a life and that indulges my interests.
So you're good at creating things that people are interested in.
I don't. No, I'm good at creating things that interest me.
So you're good at creating things that interest you, and but
and that I've been allowed to do that is wonderful. This is a silly conversation.
I'm trying to get some things out of you. Okay, so what we can end this if you want, but what is, in your view, what is the biggest game changer that you see happening in the next 5 years, and then we can wrap this up.
The biggest.
The most impactful. How about the most interesting to you?
That's better. Well, I think the most interesting to me would be a change in a workable way of setting up a learning system for large numbers of people.
So rethinking education really is needed. I completely agree, just blasting out to 1,000 people or 10,000 people and not having this interaction and an in-depth way of learning. Education is different than learning, and people learn about things they care about. And I guess where I disagree is that we do need people to learn about things that affect them, even if they might not be interested in it, because once they learn that it affects them, then they may be interested in it. So there's kind of that catch-22. Until you learn it, you might not know that you're interested in it. So there's something about that. But very interesting interview. And now we have another interesting interview with Josh Capey about anarchy. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, you have this amazing game that you created and you do with your kids. And I wanted to bring you on because I think it really, well, first of all, it's really interesting. And my son had you and he talked about it all the time. And I thought it was really relevant to what's going on in the world in general. And I wanted you to talk to our listeners about that. But before we get into that, will you give us a brief overview of your professional background?
Sure. I've been a teacher now for about 20 years. I have a master's degree in history, so my background is in history, but I'm licensed to teach all the social sciences, as most of us are these days. My experience in terms of my students, I've worked with kids from 7th grade all the way up to seniors, and I was even fortunate enough to teach a college course a few summers back.
So, with all that knowledge, you came across an idea of creating a game. What is this game and what is it about?
Well, the game is called the Anarchy Game. A lot of my games are named very cleverly like that, but I'm a big believer in games as a learning tool. And when I was a young teacher, I taught a course in civics, which, of course, is about government. And with most of the social studies, there's a lot of crossover between one discipline and the next. So these games could be used in a variety of formats. But the game is about people and how people interact together when you remove that sort of overarching thing called government. And I've played the game many, many times over the years with some fairly interesting results.
So give a brief idea what the game is about.
Well, you know, when I started, I wanted to put kids in a position where they would learn about government and government systems through actually playing the roles with democracy, with communism, monarchy. You know, I came up with different ideas for different things, and then it occurred to me that you know, the question was, well, what if we took government out of the equation? Anarchy as a absence of government to me was always very interesting. And I think it's often misunderstood what the principles of anarchy really are. So I decided, you know, well, if we're going to teach about government, you know, many kids, you know, when you're young, you don't necessarily like authority. And so, of course, you know, why do I need to do this? Why don't I need?
I think no one likes authority, even when you're older. But anyways, keep going.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting part. None of us like to be told what to do, but, you know, that one of the things I think that this game reveals is that most people, that deep down inside, that's what they really want and maybe what they really need, is for someone to tell them what to do. But, you know, the experiment was to put the kids in a situation where they have to figure out how to get along and how to, you know, according to the rules of this game, how to survive without someone telling them what to do. And that's basically what anarchy in this game is.
So what were the basic rules of the game?
Well, you divide the room into six teams, and you give them one basic objective, and that is to survive. You don't give them more than that. You don't tell them how to do it. They know what they're supposed to do. It's up to them to figure out how to do it. And I think in many ways this reflects what real life is all about. It doesn't come with an instruction manual. You have to figure it out as you go. The only thing that I teach them beforehand is what a true anarchist must believe about people for it to work. And that is that people by nature are basically good, and that it's government that creates a system of inequality and therefore makes people do things that they wouldn't naturally do. So if you remove the government influence, then people will be good and treat each other right. So it's implied that in order to survive, they must work together, although that's not specifically stated in the game.
So you don't tell the students that. You just kind of see what they do?
No, I mean, I tell them what they need to do to survive. In these six groups, they have to barter, they have to trade with each other to acquire things, to survive from one turn to the next. And then at the end of each turn, you know, we count up what do people have, and if people are short, if groups are short, then we have to start killing people off, metaphorically, of course. And as the game moves forward from turn to turn, what happens is there's less people, there's less production, there's less goods, and therefore that rolls over into the next turn, and it means less people. My prediction when the game starts, and I've made the same prediction every time I've played it, you know, well over 100 times now over the course of these 20 years, is that when we play the game, everyone in the room will die within 7 turns. And they know that.
And they're told that they know that at the beginning.
I tell them that's the prediction. None of you will be alive by turn 7.
And they all go, no, I don't. We will be.
Yeah. They always say that they can do it and they'll figure it out, but they don't know how. And, you know, part of the problem with kids in particular with this game, but also I think is also reflective of the world in general, is, you know, they don't think ahead. They think about the immediate problem and solving the immediate problem, which in the game is, where am I going to get enough food and water? But what they don't see is that as people are eliminated from the game, then that means less food and water for everybody and less people. So I think in that way, you know, there are some connections to real life and the real world. In the game, kids end up most oftentimes being very petty and very short-sighted, very vengeful toward each other. If a kid doesn't, you know, give somebody what they want, oftentimes what you'll see is they'll work very, very hard to make sure that they get back at that person, even if the consequences of revenge means hurting yourself. I think that, you know, history is full of examples of people doing the very same thing.
Do they know that they're hurting themselves when they're doing it?
Well, it's one of those lessons that they learn as the game goes along. You know, the smarter ones see it a little bit sooner. They never see it until it's too late. The game reaches a certain point where there's no coming back. There's not enough people to produce enough food and water for people to survive. And once you sort of cross that point of no return, it's only a matter of time before everybody starves to death. What I typically do when... Go ahead.
Before we get into that, what are the different roles that are in the game? Like, what are the different people so that we can get an idea of how it works a little more? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's criminals and there's...
Sure. Yeah, you have 6 groups. One group produces food, one group produces water, and they're the only ones that produce those products. Then you have one group who produces pens and one group that produces paper. And those groups are significant because in order to maintain a certain level of production, you have to pass the knowledge from generation to generation. So you have to acquire pens and papers each turn as well. And then you have these two oddball groups that don't fit into the producer category because they don't actually produce anything. I call one group the thieves and one group the weightlifters. And their role in the game, the thieves, their role is to survive as best they can. And if it means stealing from the groups, then so be it. And the weightlifters provide protection to these producing groups from the thieves. So the turn starts and everybody has, you know, what they produce. And then once they're on the clock, they have to get up and they have to move around the room and try to trade. You know, I'll give you 2 food for 2 water, or I'll give you 5 paper for 5 pens, whatever it is. I mean, the market forces really determine the price of the product, which is another interesting outcome in this game, is they start to see that price isn't just a matter of will, it's a matter of market forces. At any rate, the last group that gets to make a play at the end of the turn is the thieves. The rule is you have to have 1 food and 1 water for every person that's alive, and you have to have 2 paper and 2 pens for every person that's alive at the end of the turn. So when the thieves come to me at the end of the turn, you know, if there's 4 people in that group, then they have to have 4 food and 4 water. And if they're short, then what they get to do is to go around the room and steal from the other teams. and how much they steal is a matter of the roll of the dice. But
How do they steal?
They'll tell me, all right, we want to steal against the group that makes food. So I'll roll the dice. If, you know, let's say a five comes up, that means they get to take five items from that group. It could be five food. It could be five water. It could be two food, two water, and one pen. It's whatever they really want, whatever is in need. The thieves have a lot of control over the game, of course, because they're the last team to go every turn.
Well, then how do the weightlifters come into it?
Well, during the turn, they hire themselves out. So let's say that a group has a weightlifter working for them, and the thieves try to steal from them. Well, then whatever the roll is gets cut in half, rounded down. So if you rolled a five and you had a weightlifter working for you, then they could only take two items. So the weightlifters do provide protection.
And the weightlifters they'll get pens or paper or something for working?
That's right. They have to negotiate. I'll sell you protection in exchange for food and water, pens and paper.
So
in essence, they're selling a service. They're not really selling a product, something that they produce. They're selling a service.
So do people get really angry with the criminals?
Of course they do. Of course they do. Because
they're going to die.
You know, and they're like every other human being. The thieves, they don't want to, they don't want to perish. They want to keep playing the game. They want to keep going. And so they're going to steal to survive if that's what it takes. And I think it's what most human beings would do. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, well, yeah, you know, I'll starve to death and for the greater good. But when you're in that position and there isn't enough food, you know, it's human instinct, it's human nature that you'll do what you can do to survive. And what the thieves typically will do is to convince groups not to hire the weightlifters, that if you just give us some food and some water, we won't steal from you. Why would we have to steal from you? And then inevitably what they do at the end of the turn is turn around and steal from them anyway. You know, they'll make agreements with different groups, and, you know, the groups, the look on their face is just priceless when the thieves turn around and steal from them anyway. And then they look at me as if, aren't you going to do something about it? And that's when you tell them, yeah, do you know what the name of this game is, right? It's anarchy. There's no rules. There's no laws. There's no protection. So, you know, what typically happens is that the thieves kind of screw up the game, you know, they end up taking more than what they need. That's typical. And people end up dying off. And when people end up dying off, then suddenly there's not enough paper and pens, or there's not enough food and water. And eventually, when you play it out through enough turns, nobody survives, not even the thieves.
But do the thieves start getting pretty aggressive towards other thieves?
Well, they don't, but the other groups get very aggressive toward the thieves because they blame them for everything that's going on, that everything is the thieves' fault. Probably the reality of it is it's everybody's fault. You have an economic system, and the fundamental law of economics is scarcity. There's only so much stuff. And when one group takes more or hoards more than what they have or what they need, there's an impact on everybody else. And so people get very angry about it because they all want to win. But the way that, you know, human culture, especially in the West, the way that our minds are constructed is that winning means being the group in front when the game is over. And so they forget the fundamental lesson, which is you have to work together. The only way for people to survive is that everybody has to survive. You have to work together and take care of each other, which is what a true anarchist would say, that this is what has to be. But they don't generally see that. After we play the game the first time through and everybody dies, in 20 years, nobody's ever survived the game the first time through. They always die off. I tell them how to win. I mean, I don't tell them specifically how to win, that you have to do this and you have to do that, but I tell them that the only way to win the game is that you all have to work together, that you all have to take care of each other, that you all have to be good to each other.
And across all groups, not just across your own group.
That's right. And, you know, maybe the most shocking part of the whole story is that when we play the game the second time and everybody's been through the experience and they know what to do and they've been told what to do, more than half the time they still can't survive. Because they carry over their petty little grievances from the last game. And do you remember what you did to me last time? You remember how you stole my food? And then
Oh, they hold grudges from the game before.
Oh, of course.
So, which is so, it's so symbolic to what people do in real life. So what are some of the more interesting behaviors that you've witnessed during the game?
Well, you know, a few years back, I thought it would be interesting because, you know, as they're moving around the room, I'm not involved. I don't get involved in the discussions. I don't walk around the room to monitor anything. I just sort of sit back and mostly listen. I don't even like watching because I don't want them to feel like I'm watching them. But, you know, after a while, I just sort of fade into the background. And a few years back, I decided I was going to start writing down some of the more interesting things that I heard during the game. And, you know, it's unbelievable with these kids, you know, I'm going to kill you and that I'm going to make sure that you pay. And, you know, and I write these things down. And then at the end of the game, when we talk about, you know, being good to each other, I pull out this list of all the things that I heard during the game about revenge and about I'm going to take you out. And
if you're going down, if I'm going down, you're going down.
Yeah, you know, I don't care what else happens. You're going to die. I mean, comments like that during the course of the game. And you know, they get a laugh out of it, and it is funny, and it is fun. But I think there's also some lessons there about human nature and about, you know, the way that we really are, because I don't think it's that far off of reality. If you look at, you know, the situation in, you know, Palestine today or in southeastern Europe or in other parts of the world, it's these historical grievances that people carry with them and they can't move past it. It's hard to see a better future when you just can't stop looking back at whatever happened to you or your family 20, 50, 100 years ago.
Well, it gets pretty serious when people take your land or they kill your child and then they
Absolutely.
Can't get past it. Yeah.
A lot more serious than a high school simulation. And so, you know, if anything, the problems are more difficult in the real world than they are in this simulation.
You mean it more. When you say you're not, if I'm going down, you're going down, you really mean it. So
absolutely.
What are some of the conclusions that you came up to over the years?
Well, you know, there's sort of the base conclusions about human nature, and that was part of my interest, was finding out, you know, what's inside, you know, these kids' heart of darkness. You know, are we really good people? Can we figure out how to be decent to each other when our own survival is at stake? And the conclusion more often than not is no. Those times where kids manage to succeed in the game is where anarchy utterly fails. And you have one or two leaders in the classroom that say, okay, here's the mathematical solution. We make 20 food, that means 20 people can survive. We have 20 water, that means 20 people can survive. And they start picking and choosing who are the ones that are going to die and who are the ones that are going to live. So they can find a mathematical solution to the problem. It's not necessarily realistic, but they can solve the basic problem of the game. I'm not sure that's reality. I don't think that it translates that certain people are just going to say, oh, for the greater good, I guess I'll just starve to death. I think on the broader scale, it does say something about people being petty and short-sighted and vengeful, and very vengeful. You know, and it's kids of all ages have played it with seniors, have played it with seventh graders, and you do see grudges and people holding those grudges. Even when the class is over, I can hear them jawing at each other out in the hallway about some, you know, perceived slight that happened in the game.
So,
and they won't let it go.
So the way around that is to have leadership that forces a, is maybe not the right word, but creates an environment where people work together.
Yeah, it would be nice if the leaders were just sort of naturally compelling and that people followed them because of whatever natural gifts they have. Typically, the leaders are the loudest ones in the room. And
the biggest bully.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's another interesting conclusion from that I found, even at a school like ours where, you know, we build leaders in a country like ours where we often talk about the individual and how important the individual person is and we want everybody to be their own leader and we want everybody to follow their own path. And the reality that this game has taught me over 20 years of seeing it played at all these different age levels is that the vast majority of people don't want to be leaders. They're much more comfortable sitting in the background and allowing somebody else to take charge, that most people, in fact, want to be led.
Well, how do you deal with the thieves? Even if there is somebody that stands up and becomes a leader, there's always these thieves. Is that why they have to be more of a stronger person? They kind of force them to do it? Or how do these thieves work out?
Well, that's a great question. The thieves have the most power in the game, and very rarely does it occur to any of the thieves that they have the power to correct the imbalance in the game. If there are groups that don't want to play ball with other groups, the thieves have the power to steal, not for themselves, but to steal from one group and give to another group, like a Robin Hood type of a scenario. Very rarely do they ever see that. In doing so would help themselves and would help the group. So sometimes, you know, in successful games, it's the thieves themselves that are the, you know, so-called good guys, that they're the ones who manage the economy better than anyone else because they have the power to do that. Whereas the other groups, they have limitations and that there's only so much that they can do.
Yeah, interesting. So it gives you kind of a real life mapping of what people's emotions do to themselves and how it skews what really goes on. What real life lessons are you trying to teach the kids through this process?
Well, I think, you know, if you've been a teacher long enough, you realize that there's a lot more going on than just what your subject is. You know, if guys walk away from my classes and they have a greater understanding of how a democracy works or a little bit better understanding of their history, that certainly is what you teach. But for me, it's more about the process and learning about who you are and how you fit into the world that you're going to be entering. That the world is very big and it's a very complicated place. And it's about the process of reflection and looking at, well, here's how I played the game. What did I learn about us? But more specifically, what did I learn about me? Was I one of those guys that was, you know, vengeful, cut off my nose to spite my face, that as long as I got that other guy, it didn't matter what happened to me? And is there a way to grow from that? Is there a way to become a better person from that and realize that, you know, maybe human nature, you know, maybe we're not hardwired to do good all the time. And because we're the only animal that recognize there is such a thing as a past and such a thing as a future, that also makes us the only animal that's capable of overcoming the darker side inside of us.
Well, how do you deal with, do you teach them the fact that a lot of people are just interested in their own self, whatever is good for me, you know, that's all they're interested in?
Yeah.
And this game really shows you if all you care about is yourself, you're probably not going to make it.
Well, greed and selfishness at some level is ultimately self-destructive. You know, I think that there are parallels to the real world out there that, you know, the strength of the United States historically has been the wealth of the middle class. That's what makes us strong. It's not the ultra rich. It's the middle class. You know, you have to have buyers for an economy to work. There's a reason everybody wants to sell their products here, is because we have such a, or have traditionally had such a strong middle class. But by hoarding more for yourself, you know, I mean, it's been discussed at length, the disappearing middle class in the United States. And I think in this game, there are some very real lessons about that, about, you know, about greed and what greed can do to you at the end of the day, that taking more for yourself is not ultimately benefiting you. It's ultimately self-destructive.
So you have other games that you've created. What other ones have you created? You're pretty creative. These are awesome.
Well, when I got out of college and I got into teaching, I was always sort of driven by something my dad had said to me one time, because he wasn't a teacher. He kind of wanted to be, but he never got there. And I asked him once when I was growing up, he said, you know, why did you take all the time to do all that? And his answer was, I just wanted to see what you kids could do. And that's always been sort of my driving force, is I want to be able to see what these kids can do. And so I'm willing to take risks and try some of these games. Some of them I don't play anymore because they don't work. And some of them I still play after years and years because I think they do. I've got a game, that's based on imperialism. It's a little bit like Risk, but there's a lot more diplomacy that's involved. There's a lot more economics that's involved. I have another game with the stock market that I play that guys really like. It tries to teach them some of the basics of the stock market and thinking about how events in the world affect the economics of place, affect stock prices. And they like it because it's more of an individual game than these other ones are. It's very simple. Make as much money as you can. And the more you know and understand about the markets, the better able you are to play the game. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's all about the learning process and about learning how to be a student and how to think. And that's what all the games are really designed to do, is to help kids to come to their own conclusions and find some answers for themselves.
You made an excellent point about the fact that you want to see what kids are able to do. And one thing I notice when you're hiring people out of college is sometimes they're the ones that are able to get the most accomplished because they don't know what their limitations are. And so you can get them to accomplish just amazing things, whereas if you get somebody who's been in the workforce for a long period of time, they've kind of been put into a box for a long period of time, they're unable to do it because their mind isn't able to go there, whereas the younger people just don't know where the limitations are. Obviously, there's a trade-off for experience, but if you're really trying to get something out there done, it's amazing what you can do with some of these younger kids. And I think people forget that. You know, obviously you need leadership. And when you get executives and older people who understand what's capable, and you put them with younger people that don't know their limitations, it's just amazing what they can do. And I think it's that's what I witnessed when you were working with my son. He still to this day thinks you're the best, one of the best teachers he's ever had. You're really hard. He has straight A's. Except a few classes, and I think your class was one where he got like an A minus or something, or a B plus. He still talks about it. He goes, "But I learned so much from that class."
I appreciate you saying that. That's a huge reward for any teacher.
Yeah, I'm sure. But have you thought about marketing all these interesting games?
You know, I've thought about it, and I used to have a game. I'm kind of a writer on the side, and I used to write these simulations. It was based on the old choose your own adventure stories, where as a group collectively you read through the story and you get to a point where you have to make a decision, and then we as a group will decide, you know, what way we're going to go, what decision we're going to make. And I tried marketing those years back and I didn't have a lot of success with it. You know, for me, the marketing aspect of it and getting it out there was always sort of secondary to the next idea that came along. And, you know, what do I want to try now? What different thing do I want to try to do? And
oh yeah, you got to take that work out of the equation for somebody like you, so you can focus on doing your stuff. Keep going. I'm
true.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, I think it's, at some point in my life, maybe that's something that I'll revisit and take a look at. But, you know, there's always some new idea that I have and I want to give it a shot. And so, you know, when you're a teacher and a dad, and I have four of my own kids, your time is pretty limited, in terms of, you know, not just, you know, the physical time that you have there, but also the emotional effort that you need to sustain creating one of these things. And the marketing process is very brutal and it's very humbling. You know, you got to have the right idea and the right place for the right person. And even then, you know, it's difficult to move forward with it.
Oh, you just need, you know what you need is you need the right people to market it, because I've seen so many mediocre ideas that do well. It's just having if you have an amazing ideas like you do, and you see these things work and the kids get really into it, it's just a matter of having the right people market it for you and let you do your thing so you don't have to get mess around with it. But I think there's just so much that people can gain. Hopefully after your kids are all done and you have a little more freedom, you can bring all your wealth of knowledge to others, because this is just amazing, the things that you've done with these kids. I think if the world had more teachers like you, we would be, well, maybe we'd be more like the Asian cultures where they really value their teachers, right?
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, and it is very flattering. And you're right, I think there is something to be said about the teaching profession in the United States today, that it isn't what it used to be, that there isn't the same level of respect and reverence that there used to be for teachers. Today, I think that teachers in the United States, it's a tough profession, and a lot of young people who are going to college, you know, they really shy away from it because, you know, the pay isn't great, the benefits aren't great anymore, and maybe more important than those other things, there isn't it isn't as respected as it maybe used to be and certainly should be.
Well, I think we tend to respect the professions that make the most money. We've kind of gotten away from respecting things that are, you know, for what they are versus what money they make.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, a lot of very successful people are successful because of luck or because of, you know, they hit the genetic pick six and they were born into the right family or maybe some other factors that they can't control. That it's not as much about merit as it is about just what do you have and what achievements are out there for you. But, you know, there are a lot of people who have achieved a lot of things and I don't want to take anything away from them because I do have a lot of respect for anyone that works to achieve anything in life. It's just so difficult to do.
Well, the teaching profession is such a passion of love and giving. And so it's so amazing when you see somebody that has created so many things that work so well for young people to learn. So why, I'm going to ask this quick question. Why do you like to use it with the younger kids, like the middle school, or, you know, what do you think about the difference between the different ages that you use the games with?
Well, I think the older kids are better able to think their way through some of these problems. But with the younger kids, it's more about the pure experience. It's more about the human relationships. And so I think that the reactions that they have are more natural. So you get, I think, a bit more of a natural result with the older kids. Again, you know, like I said earlier, there's a mathematical solution to this game that may not be realistic. And the older kids tend to be better at recognizing that mathematical solution. Whereas with the younger kids, I think there's some deeper things going on because it is more of an emotional experience for them than it is an intellectual one.
And so you get to get the raw feelings and raw, you get to more of a emotional, you get to see what it really is about.
Yeah. You know, and I would love to see this game and how it would work with adults and wonder if they would be able to have any more success with it. I think it would be an interesting experiment to try to see if you know, are they able to solve the problem? And if so, do they do it on a mathematical level or do they really do it on a human level that we really need to take care of each other and be better to each other?
Well, and I wonder if you could, with the adults, you could throw in some, make it really difficult from a mathematical standpoint to solve it so that they would have to look at it. You know what I'm saying? So it wouldn't be so easy.
Sure.
And the adults wouldn't be able to solve it quickly, and then they'd have to resort to more of the human level.
My suspicion is that you would end up having, with adults, is you would end up having one or two people out of each group that would just say, okay, here's what we need to do, and then they would take over the game.
And anarchy would be done.
Yeah, you would have a clear hierarchy because that's the way the adult world works.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, thanks, Josh, so much for joining me today on this. This has been a really interesting discussion.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I've had people tell me that anarchy is the only form of government that really works, because if you have a government that's corrupt and they're controlling things and there's people that have a false sense of security, anarchy is better because at least you'll be hyper aware of the fact that there's people that could hurt you and things. But the cool thing about this interview is that he shows you that anarchy doesn't exist. There's always that power vacuum and leadership vacuum that gets filled by somebody. Anarchy just does not exist. And it's really fascinating to see how people react in situations. And I think the way the kids reacted really shows you, or is very similar to the way the adults would react. So I love that. For now, have a wonderful day.